Room 3B. Follow me. Yes, here's an empty one. It's the only one.
Well,
the minister said up here, he'll find us all right.
Oh, yes, he find what?
We'll be all right up here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Frightful mess.
Struth!
What was that?
It was 4 o'clock!
Oh, yes. 4 o'clock, a Big Ben. A
Big Ben, yes.
Yes, that reminds me. Just take a look at this, Arthur. I bet you've not seen one of these in a while, huh? Yeah, that's a fiver. I once won off Lloyd George, you know.
Yes!
Oh, yes, it's a good story. Yeah, eh?
Very, very good.
Ah, yes. I was a green young man, and he was, whatchamacallit?
Prime Minister!
Yes, Prime Minister. All the same, I knew him quite well, or rather my father did.
Your father knew Lloyd George!
Oh, yes. He used to come to our house in Queen Anne's place. You could hear Big Ben from there. Yes, that's reminding me of it. It's rather yes. Good story.
Yes, it is. Now, this is the file on that applicant for British citizenship. What do you think?
What?
These naturalization papers, we're supposed to be advising the minister. I'd like to have your opinion.
Oh, this is an application for British citizenship.
Yes. Does he look all right to you?
Well, he's got a beard. Minister won't like that.
No, then.
He asked me for my views on French, you know.
French?
Poor French, out of touch. Do you know what he said to me about French?
Who? The minister?
Yes, do you know what he said?
Oh, God. What?
Do you know what he said about French? Call him a booby.
Really?
Yes, of course. Go there.
A booby.
Yes, I was in Belgium taking a look round the village church of Etienne Saint-Just when I had the good fortune to receive a slight injury. The morning after my return to London, I remember, I was breakfasting in the window overlooking St. James's Park, and the panes of glass of the window suddenly started to pulse. Whoomp! Whoomp! As if alive to the shock waves of distant guns. And I began to sob. But it was only a motor car coming up the road. Well, the motor car stopped, and there was... doorbell jangled below stairs. Then there was a knock at the morning room door and Lloyd George was shown in. My father had already left for the R City, as he liked to put it. He had an emporium of Persian carpets in Cheapside. Which indeed was in the city. Oh, yeah. And that is where he had gone. So there was I, a young lieutenant, barely bloodied, talking to the Prime Minister of the day and receiving ribald congratulations on the shell splinter lodged in my lower abdomen. The shell itself, I may say, had made a rather greater impact on the Church of Etienne Saint-Just. I explained my father's absence. Lloyd George was in no hurry to leave, and it was then that he made his remark about French. What do they say in the field, he asked me. Were they glad to see him go? Well, I replied tactfully that we all had the greatest confidence in Field Marshal Haig. Oh, yes, Haig, he said, he's the only man to finish this war. French was a booby. A booby, that's what he said. Yeah.
A booby.
He's a booby. Well, presently, Big Ben was heard to strike 10 o'clock, and Lloyd George at once asked if it was possible to see Big Ben from the upstairs window. I said it was not. Oh, surely you're mistaken, he said. You're absolutely certain. Absolutely certain, Prime Minister. I said, oh, well, he said he found it very difficult to believe and he'd like to see for himself. Oh, I assured him there was no need. As a matter of fact, my mother was upstairs in bed making out her dinner table. She had a not unnatural desire, though to me unwelcome desire, to show me off on my leave. You know, this is my... Lloyd George pressed the point and finally said, I bet you a fiver that I can see Big Ben from Marjorie's window. Oh, all right, I said. And we went upstairs and I explained to my mother that the Prime Minister and I had a bet on. Oh, she received us gaily, just as she was in her own drawing room, you know. Lloyd George went straight to the window and pointed. Bernard, he said... Bernard, he said, I see from Big Ben that it is 4 minutes past the hour. The £5 which you have lost, he added, I shall spend on vast quantities of flowers for your mother by way of excusing this intrusion. Small price to pay, he added, for the lesson that you must never try and pit any one of the five Anglo-Saxon senses against the Celtic sixth sense. A Prime Minister, I said. I'm afraid your Welsh intuition is no match for English cunning. Big Ben is the name of the bell, not the clock. Ah! Oh, he paid up at once. And that's a fiver. I can assure you I've never spent... Oh, how they laughed. Marjorie said, that boy of yours doesn't miss a trick. Well, I left then to get a cab. Get a cab to go to old Dr. Slocum in Pall Mall, and when I came back, I saw Lloyd George alone for the last time. He was coming down the stairs. And nervousness, I suppose, made me commit the social solecism of trying to offer him his money back. Oh, no, no, you keep it, he said. I never spent a better fiver. Yes. Well, then he got into the back of the car and waved gaily and called, you'll go far in the army, that's what he said. Yes, well, he was wrong there, yes. Well, he wasn't altogether right about Haig either, you know. It was the American saved Haig.
This applicant is American?
Oh, dear. An American, yes, with a beard. Well, of course, in those days, it was the other way about. It was difficult to get British nationality without a beard. A well-bearded, mustachioed man always stood an excellent chance with the Home Secretary. A man with a moustache and no beard is often given the benefit of the doubt. But a man with a beard and no moustache, he was looked on as unreliable, probably fraudulent, and generally had to remain American for the rest of his life. Has he got property, this fella?
Well, he's associated with a stable in Kentish Town.
Oh, Epsom Down.
No. Kentish Town.
Oh, a racing stable.
No, it seems to be more of a farm, really.
Did you say he farmed in Kentish Town?
Yes.
Oh, arable or pasture?
Yes, it does seem odd, doesn't it?
Yes, I should have said that good farmland in North London was at a premium. Is he prosperous?
He has an income of £10.50 per week.
Oh, hardly a pillar of the community, even with free eggs and milk.
No.
Yes, well, he's either a very poor farmer indeed or else a farmer of genius, according to which part of North London he farms.
Yes, he's not exactly a farmer. I don't think he has other interests, publishing, and he seems to run some sort of bus service.
Oh, publishing and buses and a farm, a bit of a gadfly, is he?
Yes, and community work.
Oh, they all say that.
Yes.
Anything else? Well,
there's a theatrical side to him.
What do you mean he waves his arms about and wears colourful clothes?
No, he writes plays, puts them on and so on. Seems to have some kind of theatre.
Oh, dear, yes. A theatrical farmer with buses on the side doing community and publishing work and a beard. Are we expected to tell the minister that he's just the sort of chap this country needs? Does he say why he wants to be British?
Yes, because he is American.
Oh, well, he's got a point there. Do you know America at all?
Do I know America?
Oh, yes. The Americans, of course, are a very very modern people, a very open people, too. They wear their hearts on their sleeves and... they don't stand on ceremony, they take people as they are, and they make no distinction about a man's background, his education or his parentage, and they all say what they mean, and there's a vivid muscularity about the way they say it. They admire everything about them without reserve or pretense of scholarship. They are always the first to put their hands in their pocket. They press you to come and see them in their own homes the moment they meet you. They're irrepressibly good-humoured and ambitious and brimming with self-confidence in any company and, well, apart from all that, I've nothing against them.
Oh, my America, my newfound land.
What?
Picture the scene as our great ship with the blue riband of the Greyhound of the Deep fluttering on her mizzen rounds the tolling bell of the Jersey Boy and with 50,000 tons of steel plate smashes through the waters of Long Island Sound. Ahead of us is the golden span of Brooklyn Bay Bridge and on the starboard quarter, the Statue of Liberty herself. Was it just poetic fancy which made us seem to see a glow shining from that torch held 1,000 feet above our heads and to hear the words of a monumental goddess come softly across the water? Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. The lower decks are crowded with immigrants from every ghetto on the continent of Europe, a multitude of tongues, silenced now in the common language of joyful tears. The men wave their straw hats, shawled women hold up their babies, the newest Americans of all, destined, some of them, to become the captains and the kings of industrial empires, to invent the modern age in ramshackle workshops, to put a chicken in every pot, an automobile by every stoop, to organise crime as never before, and to fill the sky over Hollywood with 1,000 stars. Nor is the promenade deck indifferent to the sight. Many a good hand is abandoned at the bridge table. Many a dear Monty purse forgotten on the zebra-skin divans as glasses are raised at the salon windows. New York! New York!
It's a wonderful town. Already, we can see the granite towers and cliffs of Manhattan and Staten Island, too. Ablaze like jewels with a million windows giving back the setting sun. And soon, we've set foot on the new world. The waterfront is seething with life. Here and there, milling gangs of longshoremen scramble on the ground for the traditional dockets to work the piers. Occasionally, two of them give savage battle with their loading hooks. At the intersection of Wall Street with the Bowery, the famous panhandlers, the wretched refuse of cheap barrooms, huddle in doorways wrapped in copies of the Journal. Behind us, a body plummets to the ground. A famous millionaire, we later discover, now lying broken and hideously smashed among the minuscule fragments of his gold watch and the settling flurry of paper bonds bearing the promises of the Yonkers Silver Mining and Friendly Society. The air is alive with bells and sirens, but now a new sound, ghostly trumpets and trombones caught in the swirling eddies of the concrete canyons, and a few steps more bring us to Broadway. Every way we turn, excited crowds are thronging the electric marquees. Sailors on shore leave do buck and wing dances in and out of the traffic, at times upon the very roofs of the yellow taxis, bringing John Q. Public and his girl to see the sight of Baghdad on a subway. In threes and fours, sometimes in lines 100 wide, the midshipmen strut and swing up the Great White Way, chorusing the latest melodies to the friendly New Yorkers, to the dour Irish policeman swinging his nightstick on the corner, to the haughty, hand-on-hip ladies of the night. You've seen it all before. But it's time to tip our hats and turn aside, for the tall column shadow of Grand Central Station falls across our path. We are booked on the Silver Chief. Begging the pardon of a cheerful red cap, we are directed with a flashing smile to the Chattanooga train. Night is falling as we cross the Hudson. Friendships are struck, hip flasks passed around, cigar smoke collects around the poker schools. A cheerful red cap with a flashing smile fetches ice. The Silver Chief surges through the night. When we retire behind the curtains of our comfortable berths, the roaring blackness outside our windows is complete, save for the occasional pillar of fire belching from the mines and mills of Pennsylvania. And it is to fire that we awake. Woods blazing in tangerine shades of burnt umber and old gold. The fall has come to New England. The train drives relentlessly on, dividing white-framed villages from their churches and children from their hoops, and the woods give way to suburbs, and the suburbs to stockyards and slaughterhouses, and the wind is slamming off the Great Lake as we pull round the loop into Chicago! Chicago! It's a wonderful town! Businessmen in tight buttoned overcoats and grey fedoras join the poker games. C notes and G notes raise the stakes. Shirt sleeve newspaper men of the old school throw in their hands in disgust and spit tobacco juice upon the well shined shoes of anyone reading a New York paper. A cheerful shoeshine boy with a flashing smile catches nickels and dimes as he crouches about his business. The air is scented with coffee and ham and eggs. And the countryside is changing too as we swing south. Blue sky and grass are as one on the azure horizon of Kentucky. Soon, thoroughbred stallions race the train on either side. Young girls in gingham dresses wave from white wood fences. But again, untamed nature overcomes the pastures, and we climb through mountain ash and hickory into the Tennessee hills. Tumbled down wooden shacks and rusty jalopies give no hint of life, but deep in the woods, smoke rises from hidden stills. And the eye learns to pick out hillbilly groups sullenly looking up from their liquor jugs and washboards. We doze and wake to thundery, oppressive heat. Thick groves of oak and magnolia darken the windows of the speeding train and encroach too upon the fly-blown shutters of white porticoed mansions which stand decaying still high in jungle grasses that once were lawns. Atlanta is burning. A phlegmatic red caps of fried chicken and bottles of cherry soda. The poker players have departed. Big-bellied, red-eyed men in white crumpled suits swig from medicine bottles of 2-year-old sour mash bourbon. Enormous women in taffeta dresses stir the air with panhandled fans advertising Dr. pepper cordials. The train burst Alabama bound into the blinding flatlands where cotton is king and a man and a mule dominate. 1,000 acres of unfenced fields like a heroic sculpture. The sun hangs over them like a threat. Our wheels break into clattering echo as the iron girders of the Mississippi Bridge slash past our windows, sending shockwaves to make the glass pulse woof, woof around us. And far below, a boy on a raft looks up wistfully at the mournful howl of the silver chief. But that old green river rolls them along to the bend where chanting Negroes heave on the rudder poles of barges bearing pig iron from Memphis and hogsheads from St. Louis. And the last of the river boats working out of Natchez rides the oily waters like a painted castle way down yonder. To New Orleans. The train slows and crawls through the French quarter of the city on the Delta. The sun hangs like a copper pan above boarding houses with elaborately scrolled gingerbread eaves. From the red-lit shadows of wrought iron balconies, octoroon Loreleis sing their siren songs to shore-leave sailors, and sharp-suited pimps push open saloon doors, spilling light and ragtime to underscore the street cries of old men selling shrimp gumbo down on the levee. A dignified red cap hums an 8-bar blues. How long? How long has that even train been at the back of the car? A one-armed white man takes a battered cornet from inside his shirt and picks up the tune with pure and plangent notes. Soon, the whole car, Bible salesmen, buck privates from Fort Dixie, majorettes from LSU, farm boys, and a couple of nuns are singing the blues in the night. The sun drops into the smokestacks of Galveston like a dirty dinner plate behind a sofa. The train picks up speed when we retire behind the curtains of our comfortable berths. The roaring blackness outside our windows is complete, save for the occasional pillar of fire flaring up from oil wells under the cooling scrub.
I say, Arthur, I wonder if you've ever seen one of these.
10,000 head of cattle on the hoof, packed together in a rolling river of hide and horn, meet our eye when we're woken with steak and eggs by a surly red cap. The Silver Chief is on the Chisholm Trail to Abilene, Amarillo, Laramie, El Paso, Dodge. The wheels roll, the rails curve past the crude wooden crosses of Boot Hill, where lean-jawed men who once rode tall now lie in gunslingers' graves, and beyond the open prairie. Tumbleweed races the train on either side. Lone riders whoop and wave their hats from lathering ponies and are lost to sight as we hit the dust bowls of Oklahoma, where once the corn stood as high as an elevator boy and the barns shook with dancing farmhands changing partners to a fiddler's call. Now screen doors bang endlessly in the wind which long ago covered up the tire tracks of bone-rattling pickups, taking the Okies on their tragic exodus to the promised lands of El Dorado. How easy now on the gleaming rails, now carving a path through the heart of the grainlands where the gigantic mantis forms of harvesters trawl the golden ocean that fills the breadbaskets of America. We climb with the sun out of the plane. Tucson, Tulsa, Albuquerque, Wichita, Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe. Snow-capped mountains shimmer on the horizon, and still we climb from the observation platform at the rear. We watch stone-faced Indians watching the shadows turn the 1,000-foot walls of the Colorado River. Deep red and purple, huddled in our blankets, we sleep. But once we seem to wake to a nightmare of acrylic lights against a magenta sky. Huge electric horseshoes, dice, roulette wheels and giant Amazons with tasseled breasts change colour atop marble citadels that would have beggared Kublai Khan. But when the cheerful red cap shakes us, all is peace. The Silver Chief is rolling through vineyards and orchards, a sun-bathed Canaan decked with peach and apricot, apples, plums, citrus roots, pomegranates, which grow to the very walls of pink and yellow bungalows, to the very edge of swimming pools, where near-naked goddesses with honey-brown skins rub oil into their long, downy limbs. And could this be paradise? Or is it, after all, purgatory? For look, there, where movie palaces rise from the plain, searchlights and letters of fire light the sky, and a screaming hydra-headed mob surges, whipping and fighting round an unseen idol. Golden calf or Cadillac? Yeah, we do not stop to see. For now, beyond the city, beyond America, beyond all, nothing but an endless expanse of blue, flecked with cheerful white caps, with wondering eyes. We stare at the Pacific, and all of us look at each other with our wild surmise. Silent.